Welcome to the Security Today podcast. I'm your host, Uncle Bear, and this is another segment of The Room Where It Happens. I've been trying so hard to make this segment get industry leaders that are at the top of their game, and I have succeeded once more by getting Chris Wilson with Mead and Hunt in here to talk with us about his experience in the industry. So in this segment, just as a refresher, we bring in security industry leaders. We talk about where they've been, how they got into the industry, what they're doing now, and a little bit of prophecy of where they think the industry is going from their perspective. So that's exactly what we're going to do today. Chris, thank you so much for joining me. Just as a little backstory, I found Chris online, like I find most of you, and then I was out at an ESX conference, and that's where we met up for the first time, and it's just kind of been a rainbows and roses from there, but definitely love having you on this podcast. Thanks so much for coming on, and I can't wait to dig in to what we're going to talk about today. So thank you. If you want to introduce yourself, I think I said it, you're with Mead and Hunt, but you can kind of tell us just a little bit of who you are, and we'll get right on to the questions.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, humbled to have the opportunity to join and appreciate it. You know, it's funny, I was thinking about which conference that was, but yeah, it was good to finally connect in person, and eager to join the podcast and dive in here. So, you know, as you said, yeah, I'm with Mead and Hunt, security technology market leader. So what does that mean, right? I'm part of the technology team within Mead and Hunt. We're a full suite architect engineering consulting firm. I'm a part of the technology group as part of our building engineering, and I'm focused on the physical security side and working with our clients across verticals and aviation and our federal team and food and beverage and transportation and a variety of verticals where we work, making sure the customers get site assessments and design work and recommendations, security planning, getting the systems that they need, the technology that they need to protect their business and keep things going. So again, thrilled to join and appreciate it.
Awesome. That's exactly one of the reasons I wanted to have you on here, is just because of how much you've touched, you know, how much of the broadness of your career. And so I do a little bit of what I say, OSINT, open source intelligence, on my people who I bring in. It's not much. I look at your LinkedIn. But anyways, I've seen that you've been in the industry for like 15 years plus, really. And you kind of started out as that humble technician, which is another reason that I think we've connected just in our careers, is we kind of have a similar path. And so go ahead and just tell us about the early years, kind of before you came one of the strongest assets in my network, if you will. but what drew you into that security, and where did you kind of start?
Appreciate that. Yeah, I feel like most, I actually stumbled into the industry. I didn't set out to get here. So in late 99, early 2000 time period, I was actually working for a audiovisual company. So I was doing the small satellites, DirecTV, Dish Network, when they were all independent before they kind of had their own integrators doing, or own technicians doing the work. And the company was closing down for a variety of reasons. And the owner actually knew another guy that was in security. And so I got connected over there and went to work for this guy doing some security work. And I had never done any of it in low voltage. And quite frankly, was still appreciative to this day that he taught me a lot of the why behind what we do, right? He wasn't one of those that was like, hey, just hook the red wire to the red terminal and just keep it going. Like, he taught me about voltage and relays and current and a lot of different things that, you know, even in my college days of taking class, I didn't fully appreciate and get. So so I got into the security industry by mistake. I started out as just a technician. And kind of fell in love with it. Quite frankly, access control and relays, like I was hooked right away, and I was interested to know more. What can we do? And then when you start learning about what can you do and what's possible, even today, I tell people, like, you just unlock a door, that kind of gets boring in access control, but there's so many other things that you can make systems do as part of that. And so, yeah, I spent 15 years on the integrator side, if you will. So yeah, technician, worked my way up through, you know, lead, project engineer, service management, operations management. And then 2014 made the switch over to working for a couple of manufacturers and doing some consulting work along that side. So yeah, pretty broad perspective, but always drawn to the technical side without a doubt.
Yeah. And that's something that I love to hear, because that you're, you know, early on you had some mentor kind of teaching you and telling you the why behind what we do it. Looking at you today and, you know, the asset that you are in networks, not just mine, but I see that you're providing to the industry something that would be missing if you weren't here. And that right there is a testament to, if we're going to start with the basis of education, we're going to give somebody the, you know, the full scope, and we're actually going to pour into them and teach them about our craft and about our skill, then the sky's the limit, you know, shoot for the moon at that point, because they get hooked. Like you said, they feel like, oh my gosh, I love this stuff. Let's see what else we can plug into it and not let the smoke out, you know? So, yeah, I think that's really encouraging to hear. And so is there anything, and you know, I think about this often because I also started as just kind of a technician. I also fell into it. I think we all do a little bit. But is there anything that you appreciate about how you got into the industry now that maybe you didn't appreciate then because you didn't know, or it wasn't something that was a priority? But is there anything like that? Because I think about that sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's interesting. So I mentioned the owner of a company that I was leaving that was closing actually introduced me to the owner of this other company that's like, hey, got a referral. You know, it's a, that has always stuck with me. You know, you mentioned networks, and again, appreciate the kind words, thrilled to be part of it. But it's really about understanding the networking side of it. Like, there's a human factor to this, and understanding that goes a long way. And again, I didn't appreciate that at the moment. I thought I was just, you know, college days, it's time for a job, I gotta pay the local bar tab or whatever it is, right? I mean, that was the area. It wasn't about long term, it wasn't about building a network. LinkedIn wasn't around. Like, I never even, in fact, we were in the same town, in a fairly small town at that time. I didn't think about that part of it and didn't appreciate it. It wasn't until later in life that I really understood the human factor of that networking, and then again, truly the value of the why, you know, behind that. It's why I try and educate and share that knowledge. That's part of what we've got to do. Invest in the people, teach them the why, not just hook the red wire to the red terminal and the black wire to the black terminal and make things work. Because the reality is, we still need these hardware pieces, and things are going to get cooler and cooler, and there's a lot of great stuff happening, but it's not a, you know, it doesn't just magically disappear and we no longer need hardware to do all this stuff, or, you know, that's still going to be a thing. And so we need people to understand how to make that work. It's funny you mentioned the smoke out. There's a, one of the companies that I used to work for, and I won't call out their name. I used to head up their tech support department. And we were on a call one night, and it was later, and we'd had quite a few calls, and we were wrapping up for the evening, and we had a technician that I was on the phone with. And this is one of two stories that those guys told for a while. He was working on something, and he was getting ready to power the control panel up the wrong way. And before I could tell him stop, he's like, oh no, I think I just smoked it. And I was like, hurry, 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 get the box. You got to catch that. And he's like, well, what? I was like, no, you got to catch that smoke. And he's like, what are you talking about? I was like, well, you're going to have to send that back to us for repair. You got to send me the smoke so I can put it back inside. And he's like, you're an idiot. Like, you know, but the thing is at that point it's toast. And
yeah,
someday I'll give you the other story, but it's like, you know, you got to have a little fun along the way. But it's also appreciating what's going on in the world around, and having that technical knowledge goes a long way.
Yeah, definitely. It's always good to, you know, stick it to a couple technicians too, every now and then, you know what I'm saying? just to bring them down a notch.
Remember, that's humor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, that's awesome. And I really like that. There's some themes or motifs that I try to work into the podcast, like, you know, security is a mindset, and, you know, security is a right, privacy is a right. And I think I'm going to start working in something along the lines of that. Networking is a piece of this too, because you're right, that human factor really can kind of change your whole career if you pour into it. If you're there and you're investing yourself either into something like LinkedIn, or, you know, when you're working for a company, you're not just putting in your hours, but you're learning the guys around you, you're learning the guys above you, you know, just to say, hey, just to kind of push that network. That's a huge factor in building a career and becoming an asset to the industry. So I can appreciate that
100%.
Too. So I did totally see, agree. And I've been waiting for this. I've been waiting for this week. I told my wife earlier this week, I'm like, I am about to interview this guy, and he worked multiple years in Afghanistan, and I need to know the details. So I saw you worked in Afghanistan, so I want all the details. What does this even mean?
Yeah, so I was a contractor for almost 2 years in Afghanistan. I covered, all told, I visited 17 different bases while I was over there in the 2 years that I was there. So I originally went over as fire alarm subject matter expert for the entire country. And while that sounds like it's a whole lot of stuff, if you stop and think about it, there's only fire alarms on a few of the bigger bases. So I spent a lot of time at some of the larger bases. The little bases don't even have, you know, they got a battery powered smoke and no fire alarm. So I went over there to, they didn't have anybody doing fire at the kind of that senior level. And I had some fire background, had been doing some NICET work, and it was a good opportunity to go over. And I was never in the military. I've got a lot of family that was in the military, and I've got a lot of respect for that. And I kind of felt this onus to kind of do my part. And I didn't want to enlist at that time. I did actually try at one point. That's a different story. But yeah, so I spent, again, almost 2 years over there. The first, 12, 14 months was fire alarm subject matter expert. As part of that time period, the contract transition from the one contract, LogCap 3 to LogCap 4, and one contractor left and a new one picked it up. And as part of the new contractor that I worked for, I was actually doing network admin work. So I covered about 300 users in 5 different bases. And that's when I finally got a little bit further out away from the flagpole and kind of went to some more of these little remote places. And yeah, again, I had 17 different bases in the time I was there, had climbed a couple of towers in the time out there. Got to work with some amazing people and still some friends to this day that I met over there. But, you know, it's kind of what you expect. It's not living all the luxuries of life. You know, you're living in a plywood building, eating at the chow hall, and you hope the supply truck showed up or the supply plane showed up to resupply the PX. But, you know, I think our military is doing is fantastic and amazing. And I was just glad to have the opportunity to go support them and provide them security and communications and things like that while I was over there.
So I got two questions for that experience. The first is, what did your average day even look like? From waking up to going to bed. And then what did your average weekend look like? I mean, were you out there like at the goat stand, you know what I'm saying? Getting what you needed.
So the thing that comes into play is weekday or weekend doesn't matter. Every day's the same.
Yeah.
Every day's Groundhog Day. We would work usually anywhere from 3 to 6 months in theater, in country working, and then 2 to 3 weeks out of the country, and then go back in country for a couple of weeks. But when you're there working, it doesn't matter what day of the week it is. Usually it was waking up around 6 a.m., getting up for morning, you know, check-in meetings and kind of team meetings, getting through what's going on. You know, when I was probably the latter half, it's probably easier to kind of go through. When I was doing network admin work, right? Is anybody putting any tickets? Anybody having any trouble? Anything from the satellite uplink is having trouble? They wake me up in the middle of the night for that. But, you know, or the printer's out of ink. Is there a wireless shot to the electrical shop or the defect that needs some work? Like any of that kind of stuff. So very, very similar parts. You just, you know, you had a gator or you're walking across the base to go figure out what you need to do. Usually worked like 12 hours, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Get done with work. I'd go hit the gym for a little while, go grab some dinner, rack out for a couple hours, and do it all again the next day. And again, you do that 7 days a week, all the time. But, you know, it's just a matter of, I guess I had a little bit more flexibility in my schedule because I was one person. And, you know, if I was at traveling to different bases, or, you know, when I was working on fire alarm stuff, they might call you in the middle of the night. I got a call one night that we had an issue at a hangar, and, you know, they're getting you on the radio at 2 a.m. Whatever, it doesn't matter. And whatever time the work needs to be done, you're going there. But yeah, usually it's 12-hour days, And you know, a lot of time in the gym, a lot of time in the gym while I was over
Well, right
there.
on. Yeah, so from all of that, you kept going, and it looked like you went from service manager to engineering, and then you landed like a pretty good stint at Paxton, for especially the for this day and age. So what was the transition like through kind of multiple different roles into sales, and then climbed the VP of operations, and now you're like on the consulting side of it? What's that transition been like, kind of moving through that?
Yeah, it was interesting that, you know, there was a couple things that correlated. So 2014, I was living in Baltimore and wanted to get back to South Carolina to see to the other side of my family lives in South Carolina. And so I had a conversation with the at that time president from Paxton, Bob McKee, and he was looking to grow the team from Paxton in the US, but again, transparency, he said, like, you know, he didn't have anything that was exactly what I wanted. But it was an opportunity to take a shot at trying something different and also get, you know, get the move. So I actually started at Paxton as an inside sales rep, which most people, if you know me, you would not typically say, Chris is our inside salesperson. That's not the usual go-to, but it's the role I took. And you know, and still, again, I appreciate Bob for giving me that opportunity because if you look at my resume as solutions engineering and service manager, inside sales wasn't the natural gravitation to go to, but I did. And that lasted about 30 days. I took over and led the support team there. After leading the support team there for about 60 days, I took over the operations manager role, which was a newly created role. Paxton was in a great growth period when I moved there. And so there was a lot of things happening very quickly, right? The tech support team was growing. You know, this operations role came out. I started then building out the US factory. They didn't have a US factory because everything is Paxton's based in the UK. So I worked with the UK team. We built out the US factory. The product manager at the time that was based in the US decided to make a different career path. And I thought, hey, let's throw my hat in the ring and try something new. And so switched over to the product manager side. And then a little while after that, they kind of restructured, and that's when I took over the VP of Ops and Product Management role. When they restructured, kind of how the US team was set up, we actually went from having one president to three vice presidents, and I took one of those three roles. So I think it was just all about the opportunity, doing really well in what you're doing, and people see the opportunity to kind of take on something else, but also having a little bit of, you know, gumption to just dive in there, right? Throw your hat in the ring. And if there's something that looks like fun, you know, learn what you can about it. But you know, you can only know so much. I mean, you know, and very same way, we were just talking about Afghanistan. My brother was in the military, and my dad was in the military, my uncles. I heard a lot about what it was like over there. But I'll never forget the moment that you step off the plane in Bagram, Afghanistan, and look around on the airfield, and there's this idea like, what did I just sign up for? And there's some roles along my career path that have been like, oh yeah, I want to do that. And then I get in the role and it's like, what did I just sign up for? But you know, some of them are the good fit, and sometimes you just you know, dig in and learn a little bit more, and then the more you know, you can it kind of materializes into what you want it to be. So I got lucky, right? I took the opportunity to be able to push it myself, but I also was fortunate to join again Paxton at that time. I was there almost 5 years. And they went, I think I was like number seven in the US, and we were 50 something people when I left just in the US. So they grew quite quickly in a couple of years, and I happened to be in on the early part of that growth trajectory.
Yeah, so can you expand just a little bit for maybe a listener that would be wanting to, advance in their career quickly, or, move through those ranks? I know that it's not an overnight thing. Sometimes people think, that it's like the Facebook story of overnight, you're this multi-billion dollar thing. But what would be like advice for somebody who wanted to, because you've done a really good job at it. You've hopped from here to there and used your skills and experience to kind of get to where you're at. So what would be your advice on that end?
Yeah, I think the first piece is it takes a lot of years to be an overnight success in most cases. So,
Yeah.
you know, it's a slow burn. And I think that the best advice that I can give is understand what you're good at. Understand, you know, the Venn diagram is want should, right? What are you good at? What do you want to be doing? What skills do you have that you that should, and have a little self-awareness on that side. But also, if you see a role that you're interested in, reach out and try and understand that. And then also try and connect the dots. What do I do today that translates over to what I want to be doing? And I'll give you a couple of examples, right? I was a technician and I wanted to move into less hands-on technical work and more like solutions engineering. Mm-hmm. Well, I figured out that the best solutions engineers know how this stuff goes in and they know how to make it work. They're writing a better bill of materials. They end up as a consultant writing a better specification. So I was saying, okay, well, I already know this stuff from a technical. I can put together a bill of materials. Well, how do I just then translate that into being a solutions engineer and ask the right questions? And you're doing the same work. You're just earlier, you're at a different stage in the process. And so being able to think about those things of, you know, what do I want to be doing? What am I really good at? And again, a little self-awareness can go a long way, or, you know, have a mentor, have some conversations there. And then also just do the research, you know, spend the day shadowing somebody. If you find out somebody is doing a role that you're interested in, go see if you can shadow them for a day, right? We all learned about that in like middle school or something where you could shadow your parents for a day. Like, yeah. It's not a bad concept. You know, I rode along with a couple of people and I can remember distinctly, there was a couple of ride alongs and I was like, man, I am glad this is not my everyday. And I knew more, right? But yeah. you at least learn that.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that. I think that you make a good point. So when you started to talk about, like, you know, make that plan, what can I do today to do, you know, what I want to do tomorrow? When did you in your career start thinking pretty farther forward like that? Because I can say from my experience, it probably wasn't until I was 5 or 6 years in that I started going, okay, what do I want to do with my whole career? You know, like, what are now like big forest wide view goals of what I want? So where did you start thinking that far forward?
I would definitely agree. It was probably a good 5, 6, 8 years in that I kind of started thinking about that. And I'll tell you, I've actually probably been through two paradigm shifts, if you will, in kind of a career path, right? It was, well, if we think about first, even thinking about it as the first one, which I'm not even considering, but the first aspiration is like, what do you want to do? And typically, and for me, it was, I want to run a company. I want to be at the top levels of leadership. I want to do like, and again, I kind of achieved that when I got to, again, VP of Paxton. I was the highest, one of three of the highest, you know, ranking people, if you will. I kind of hate that term ranking, but you know, highest level people in the US team, right, at that point. And I also realized then there was a point in time later where it's like, is that the measurement of success? And the next pivot for me was actually more around what I do now, which is about spending time with clients and doing more deep dive and solutions delivery and designs and assessments. And my definition of success has changed over that career as well, which also has changed what that goal and aspiration is, right? I love what I do every day. I get to do some travel. I get to spend time with clients. I get to understand their pain point, and we get to help put together solutions to solve for a lot of that and ultimately provide safety and security for a lot of times the public. And I love it. I absolutely love it. But if you ask me 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if that was my definition of success, it was different, right? It was about the leadership and the stature. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, don't get me wrong. And I think that's the other factor to consider is how do you define success as an individual, and also be willing to accept that may pivot and change. And it did for me. You know, at first it was, I want a paycheck. And then it was, I want to run a company and have this high level title. And then it's actually like, no, I kind of miss just being in the weeds a little bit some days and writing specs and getting involved with drawings, and kind of pivoted back to that. It was an opportunity to redefine that and make that shift.
Yeah. I feel as if that goal, like you said, it's not bad if like leadership or running your own company is your goal. In fact, it's almost necessary, because that will start the path or the journey. And then it's interesting how your career goals, they shift, they mold, they turn into different things and over time. And you kind of need them to start off in that basic, I feel like it's a pretty elementary wish for, as you know, someone who's new to an industry, to be like, well, one day I'd like to have my own company where I'm the top dog in this thing that I'm investing my time into. Not that when you are that top dog and you've chosen to run your own company, that's not elementary in the slightest. So it gets very difficult very quick. But having those future goals and looking forth into your career, I think is a huge aspect that if you're not doing now as a listener, you need to be, you know, just so that you're being that better tech, you're being that better person, that you're investing back into the world in some regard. So after that stint of kind of like engineering in several companies and stuff like that, what can you give us a synopsis of kind of the role that you do now? Because you just kind of talked about it, but can you detail that a little bit more?
Sure. Yeah. So I spend a lot of time not only doing some work to find clients that we're going to do work with. So if you were to kind of put that into a business development / sales role. So there's a portion of what I do that's kind of meeting new clients and understanding what their needs are and is it a good fit for us, and then, you know, engaging them to do the work. So that's kind of a sales type function. But I also spend time actually doing site assessments. You know, I was out on a couple of projects recently, actually, you know, doing site assessments and working with vendors and manufacturers to understand what technology then can help solve for these and kind of putting together some of those. I'm fortunate now where when I had my own consulting, I was kind of a one-man band, and I would partner with other consultants to kind of deliver solutions. I'm fortunate now, and while we still do partner a lot, we've also got technology designers and project managers and CAD BIM people, and I've got a better team, but I still enjoy that opportunity to have those conversations. And again, I go back to that technical. I'm working on a project right now where I was able to have conversations with vendors around making sure that we're selecting the right product and kind of refining and keeping those technical skills, you know, sharp, because that's what I find value in. That's what I really enjoy and am passionate about. And then deploying that with partnering with clients. So, you know, I spend a lot of time in kind of both sides of that, if you will, of it's a doer on the technical side, but it's also a little bit of a salesy seller type role, which I've found to be a good balance. Right. And I think the other thing is there's a gray area between. Oftentimes in the industry, we talk about a role, right? You're a tech, you're a solutions engineer, you're a salesperson. And I think the beauty of it is there's a gray area in some places in between where you can do some sales functions and also still be highly technical, or you can blend that a little bit. We need definition just the same way we need people to be leaders and we need people to be techs. But there's oftentimes a gray area where you can kind of blend that. And that's what I love about the current role, is being able to leverage all that deep technical knowledge and ask very direct and pointed questions and get answers, but then also be able to make sure that we're having the right, you know, long-term strategic and relationship conversations. And again, I'm literally sitting here thinking about it. It goes back to the very first question you asked me, right, about my career, right? The two things that I took the most away was from the interpersonal networking and building that connection and what I learned from a technical side. And today, I get both sides of that. And maybe that's why I love what I do every day, because I kind of get to balance both pieces of that. There you go. Light bulb moment in real time. There you go.
Awesome. That's what we're here for. You know what I'm saying? So this is my favorite part of the podcast then, because I want to get kind of into, we talked about where you've come from, we're talking about what you're doing now, and then talking about the future, because I do feel that there is a lot going on the bleeding edge of security. And I actually started this podcast with a friend of yours, Leah Dess, and he was on the first segment. And he kind of comes on and he's talking about like high level, the next, you know, thing to happen in the industry. And I was like, that's excellent. He like helped me realize that that's what I wanted in this segment also, is to talk about what's coming down the pipe, if you will. So with that, as a consultant, and kind of, you know, I'm really intrigued with your perspective on it, because you have that technical side of things, and you have that like finding solutions and pain points side, and kind of what you were just speaking on. As that consultant with a good solid career in the space, what What do you feel like security is growing into at a rapid rate? What do you think that, maybe just a broad shot of what's coming down the pipe, and then I have a couple more specific questions that to follow that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of, I'm going to say, fundamental shifts that I see happening, right? Software, number one, is a big impact where, if when you look at the industry, we were a hardware industry, right? We were, you know, well, at the very end days, intrusion systems were single circuit, right? It's a wire that ran around the building and came back to itself in the very, very early days. And then we got to these sophisticated systems that could talk to a computer, but we had to run a serial cable to them and plug them in with a dongle. And, you know, then we had all these air gap systems. Like, we were a hardware centric industry from a security perspective.
Yeah.
And I think the dynamic of software coming in is making a fundamental shift. Again, and I said it earlier, hardware is not going away, but it's changing the relationship of how it functions, right? It's not hardware first. I think we're moving to a software first dynamic. And I think there's a lot of things that are going to start to happen from a convenience standpoint, a user experience standpoint, a flexibility standpoint, that's going to be driven by these software first applications. Whereas instead of selecting your hardware and then the software to make it work, you select how you want the software to work. And then what's the hardware I need to support that? And I think that's going to make, I see companies already having that conversation. I think that's going to make a big difference. So I think that's the first big piece. And I think the next one that I'm having a lot of conversations around, and oh, by the way, I don't think everybody gets that yet. And I don't think that we as an industry get that, the software first idea. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we know fully what it means yet. And so there's a lot of conversations around how do we prepare for what we think is coming, because we're not there yet, right? I think the other big piece that I'm going to kind of bucket it into, if we delineate that, there's a lot around data. You know, shout out to Rob Kay from Rivian. He was at the ACS event Lee did, and he talked about data as unrefined oil, right? If you put unrefined oil in a barrel, it does nothing, right? You have to go through this refinement process, and then you have to do some other things in my industry, but you have to, just sitting in a barrel, it's no good, right? You refine it and you process it, and then you can finally put in a vehicle where you can drive with it and you can run your engine, right? It's the same thing with data. If you just collect all this data and throw it in a database, a data lake, a data warehouse, whatever, it's essentially worthless. You have to process it and refine it and use it and ask it meaningful questions and understand it in order to actually make decisions on it. And I think that's becoming more and more relevant. And then that opens the door to privacy as well, right? So what data are you collecting? How long should you collect it? What should you do with it? And all of that, which ties into the cyber side. And it's, again, I'll say that because the things that I'm not saying, I'm not talking about mobile credentials. I'm not talking about the cloud. Like, are those things? Yes. However, these are two big things that they're driving the everyday conversation that I'm having with clients and people in the industry. And it's how is that going to impact us? And ultimately it filters down in a variety of ways how we deal with it. But I think those two things are massive trends that are started. They're here. They're not going anywhere. And they're only going to continue to grow in a variety of ways.
What do you feel like for your first point being, you know, that software kind of coming in with a heavy hand? What are some implications for technicians who are getting into the field now, with their experience of where this industry is going when that software really starts to take a hold? What does that look like for maybe newer technicians, you know, comparatively to maybe what it looked like for us when we were getting into the field?
Sure. Yeah, I think when we got into the field, we were often trained on a hardware platform, right? You went to a manufacturer or you learned how a piece of hardware worked. And then we often just deployed that hardware in different building types. And I think the difference is good from a new technician perspective. The challenge we get is people don't understand the hardware side as much because we're not training on that. We're not educating. They understand the software. So good, because that's where we're headed. And I think they need to know that. I would say from new technicians, you still need to know the hardware fundamentals. You still need to understand, you know, how some of these fundamental things operate. You know, we're moving from a world of, instead of a relay output, it's a digital output, but fundamentally it's still going to have similar characteristics, and you still have to know how to interconnect those things. And so I would say that it's less about understanding how a specific manufacturer's hardware works, but more understand the general concept. How does a relay work? How does, you know, voltage work? Things like that. And that's then more applicable to whatever hardware piece you're given. And then what they're going to need to know is a bit more on the software side. You may have to know a few different softwares in how do they operate. But I think it's going to also start to gray that area between, I can remember a period where we had a cabling crew that just pulled cable. We had a devicing crew that just installed devices, and we had a programming crew. And so often the programmers then got to be at one point remote because they could have remote access, like magic stuff, right? And I think that's blending, right? The people that can pull a cable and mount a small device on the end and then program it, because now you can program it from a phone or an iPad or whatever. It's blending those skills kind of back together. And again, as you think about it, early days, one person did everything. They could pull the cable and hook it up because it was a hardware system. Then as the systems grew, they kind of diverged, and we had these three different crews do it. And now we're kind of coming back together where there's kind of a single person that could be, you know, we're not there yet, I don't think, but we're getting closer and closer with some of the products where things can be, again, programmed from a smartphone. We don't need a dedicated programmer, but we still need people that understand rules and, you know, access groups and things like that from access control or how to program things. So I guess it's a little bit less depth on manufacturers. It's a better understanding broadly across the technology and the electronics we use in this industry, and then also pairing that and how it interfaces with the software that's out there.
Yeah, I wonder if it is due to some of the trade shortage that's coming back into kind of a one technician thing, because I think of some of the technicians we have at Sprinter, and we're asking them to pull the cable, and in some instances we're asking them to like set up the Salto system locks when they're on site. You know what I'm saying? So, but we do that because we have a smaller crew, and I know from, you know, being in those interviews and, you know, putting out job listings, it's hard to find somebody who can come in and fill those roles, right? But it's also kind of hard to find somebody anyway. And so, you know, that I'm going to pull them in,
yeah,
and they're going to get on the crew, and I'm going to need them eventually to do kind of all three of those things. I need them to pull that cable. I need them to be able to, because that's kind of the state of the world. And you're right, you're doing it from your phone now, you're doing it from an iPad, and that just helps the company out altogether. Not just Sprinter, but any integrator company out there. But yeah, I wonder if that is kind of pushing it back together, because I agree. I think that you, and you know, I did feel this when I was an early on technician, when I was just a couple years into being a low volt tech, I felt like, you know what, I need to know how to program it, right? And I would hang around. At that point, I was working for a low volt integrator, and I was on the AV side of the house. And so I would hang around and kind of get in trouble, you know, with the other techs. They're like, why are you not pulling cable? And I'm like, sorry, I was talking to Dan, because Dan was programming this thing, and Dan liked to hear himself talk. So Dan was just talking about how he was programming it. And I'm like, I kind of want to sit there and listen to as he programs it, right?
Yep.
And that's a serious value. To your second point, you know, that is kind of leading the industry, that data side of things, it gets a little difficult for me, because I feel that our language or our verbiage that we've used in the company, or I'm sorry, in the industry, and then as that cyber and that physical gap close, cyber is coming with an even, you know, a 3 times the size dictionary into our space. And it gets muddled. And so we easily say like data, but like you had to clarify, I'm not talking about this, I'm talking about this. With that data, do you have any off the top maybe ideas of what that physically would look like if we were able to refine that oil that you're talking about? What that would look like within our security environment if we had accurate data points that was stored and that was translatable?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I think it turns into, again, there's buzzwords out there, right? There's this convergence, there's a physical and cyber, there's digital transformation, there's a lot of these words that all, again, and I love the point that, you know, the dictionary is getting bigger and bigger as we get into that. And we're even seeing now where people are using the term cyber resilience instead of just cybersecurity. So not necessarily wrong. As the world is evolving, we're changing our language around that. But I think there's a couple pieces around data that stand out to me. Is number one, it's how do we collect it and what do we do with it, right? So how do we collect it? Too many times these systems have been siloed or are still siloed, right? It was a feature, a selling point when your access control can tie to your video surveillance, and when the card swipes, you can trigger an event in the video surveillance. Mm. Well, if you've worked for any of the manufacturers, there's even a conversation there of, well, who has the, you know, does the video surveillance keep the video? Does that video clip get sent to the access control system and they have to store it? Who has the tag and the data? Like, even something as simple as that, there was not an industry standard of how we do things, right? So I think when we get to these data points around ultimately moving to a data lake, data warehouse, where we can feed in metadata from the access control, where we can feed in metadata from the HVAC and the lighting and the, you know, the air quality and the, you know, all of these energy utilization, maybe video surveillance, the intrusion system. And it's selected data points that we're bringing into one location, because then what do we do with it? We can now put a dashboard on that to make it user interface, right? We can start to say, okay, now it's digestible. Now we've refined it. Now we can start making business decisions. And I'll use the example. There was a client that I worked with where there was a project that there was a multi-story building, you know, after hours, it was closed. They came in one day and found that the one of the doors on like the bathroom on the third floor had been used like crazy overnight. And they're like, what is going on, right? It's the access control data. It was occupancy sensor data. And we were able to go, and then we could go, okay, wait a minute, let's go pull the video surveillance. So we pulled all these different data points. We also had cleaning records from the cleaning crew the night before that it was cleaned and it's trashed the next morning. And they're like, we've got data points here saying some anomaly happened. And without having those data points connected, they would have never figured it out. Well, what they figured out was directly across the street, there was a large event venue. There was a concert that let out at midnight from a bunch of rowdy Tool fans. The band Tool had been playing in town. They let out at like midnight, right? So, you know, probably not the white collar buttoned up crew. They'd had a few drinks. They've been having a good time. Rock on. Good for that. They need to go to the bathroom. And somebody somehow figured out there was an unlocked door and up a stairwell and you could get in the third floor and there's a bathroom. And like 100 people went to this bathroom.
Well, oh my gosh.
It was crazy. But it's the connection of those data points that allows that to then happen. And then, you know, then the actions are, oh my gosh, we need to figure out our access control. Why is that door unlocked? Blah, blah, blah. Like there's, but it's seeing all those things connect. You know, if you don't have that, you go, why is the bathroom trash? You may go, well, the cleaning crew didn't do their job, fire them. Well, no, they did, right? And it's that dashboard, it's the accessibility of having all that data together and not going to six different systems to be able to pull it, to be able to do that.
Yeah, the server gets really important really quick in that standpoint when you're pouring all that data into one well so that you can, you know, kind of sift through and make sense of it. I also think of from the data aspect, which I'm really glad you brought that up, because I do feel like not only is software kind of under the radar or not being recognized as this thing that is wildly shaping our industry, but it is that data. And I have thought for a long time since I studied for my as-is PSP, they had this little tiny section in that big, huge textbook that was on it was on data points. They didn't call it that. I can't remember what they called it, but this was like 3 or 4 years ago, so that it wasn't really even being talked about yet. But it was on those data points from a serviceability standpoint. So if I know that you know, the southeast door into the parking garage is giving me a door forced, you know, 500 times over the last 2 weeks, and I know that that's not a very frequented door, then you can service that more quickly. And so it's using that data in a serviceability aspect to secure your security system, because people pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for security systems. And I often think about that serviceability side of like, well, if you're going to pay that much and then nobody knows that the southeast door is giving a door forced 500 times, and then one of those door forceds was actually a tool fan trashing your bathroom, then you're like, now you're like, oh, well, I wouldn't have caught it or known it because I'm not even watching that metric. And so, yeah, you know, we saw it go for 50 times one night, and we sent a guy out there, and he found out that it was, you know, that it was wired wrong, or it was shorting, or, you know, it was something in the software or something like that. And we got it fixed. And by, you know, the fifth night, when the tool fan came out and checked the door, it wasn't open. Right. So using that data also from a serviceability standpoint, I think that's a really good add on to exactly what you were talking about. So from that, then I guess I want to ask this question too. And I think I'm going to make this more of a question that I ask every episode. But in 3 to 5 years, what do you feel like security is going to look like? And then maybe like even a 10 year forecast, if you get on a roll with your 3 to 5 prophecy or whatnot. But what is it looking like from the user experience standpoint? You know, I walk into a building, and what does the security even appear to be like in 3 to 5 or 10 years plus?
Yeah, I think 3 to 5, we're going to start seeing some of these ease of use things coming into play more and more. And what I mean by that is, and I'm going to try not to use some of the buzzwords that have been floated around, but there's a lot of ways to just, you know, approach a facility. It knows who I am. It knows what things should happen as a result of who I am and what my preferences are, or rights are, or permissions are, or things like that. And it starts to become seamless, right? It's locked, it's secured, but when the right people are there, it becomes seamless. And the difference being that it's not an action that I deliberately am taking necessarily. It's starting to become a bit more intuitive and easy flowing. And I think the short term is going to be in 3 to 5, we're going to start to see some of these things come about, and there's starting to be products that are out there now to do it. That they're lower impact. They're starting to move in that direction. But I think in 3 to 5, we're still going to see a bit of the legacy mindset. You know, we're not necessarily historically known for being the industry to be early adopters, shockingly, in technology. And we're, you know, we're still doing some very, you know, legacy things. And I think there's ways that we could do that. And I expect there's going to be a bit of a slow turn, but I also expect it's going to have, I'll use the term hockey stick, right? So kind of a slow turn. And then once it gets going, it's going to escalate pretty quickly. And I think by the time you get to these 10-year marks, I think that's going to start to be the difference, where things become intuitive, they become convenient, they become seamless, they become literally at your fingertips. You know, I saw one of the AI buttons where it can project an image down on your hand of a phone number, and then you can talk through it. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but I think things like that are going to start coming around. And I think that we're going to get to a point where those things get incorporated as part of the way that we live, but they're also, we got to incorporate them the right way. We got to have some guardrails. And I think that's some of the challenges that we run into today, is there's some just open areas of just a free for all. And then there's some areas where we've kind of put blockers and guardrails in certain places. And I think we've got to get some uniformity across that, and kind of regulate some of those pieces in order to make it easier and more appropriate to implement. But ultimately, it's going to be about convenience. And I think that's the difference. I think I've heard it mentioned a couple times. I think Lee even mentioned it. It's a paradigm shift from keeping the bad people out to letting the right people in. And fundamentally, if you break that down, you're doing the same action, right? You're locking the doors for people that don't have access, and you're unlocking it for people that should. But the way that you articulate that, the way that you think about it, is fundamentally different. And I think that's going to start to, it's already driving some of the way that systems are getting deployed. But I think it's also, security is becoming integral in the design, right? In the, not an afterthought. It's more integral in how the building operates and functions, you know, things like wayfinding. And by having a credential and an identity of who somebody is, if six people are sitting in a conference room, we now know each of the preferences for air temperature, and we can normalize that among their preferences. Or we know who the six people are, and we know that the CO2 levels have now gone up. And so we need to do more turns of the air or introduce fresh air to offset the air. Like, there's things like that that are just changed the way that we live and feel in a building. But we've got to be able to bridge that gap of identity and authentication to get to that level of convenience. But I think we're going to get there. I just think it's a process.
It's a process for sure. Yeah. And, I think you're right. We've been slow to adopt as an industry, which I almost think might have saved us, but we need to know when to let go, you know, and when to be like, okay, now we're farther enough along. It's not its first update. So we can kind of start to implement some of these things. I agree wholeheartedly. So just to help the listener, you know, kind of start to imagine, when you say that it's seamless in that, that, you know, you'll see it in the next 3 to 5, and really in that 10 years time span, it'll just be a seamless interaction with the security system as a user. That means what? Like walking up to the building and the door just unlocks. Is the reader going to go away at some point? Are we even really going to need it?
There's already systems that don't require a reader at the door. Yeah. And yeah, I think that's exactly it, right? We can, you know, you just walk up to the door, either it's, you know, and again, I don't know the answer. Is it facial? Is it palm? Is it some other biometric? Is it an NFC off of a mobile device? Is it an implanted chip in my wrist? Like, we don't know the answer. All of these have been tried, and some of them are out there every day. So
yeah,
you just kind of, you can walk up, you can, you know, the door opens because it knows who you are. You know, there's video systems that can monitor for tailgating so that the wrong people don't, you know, we're not having tailgating issues. Then because it knows that I've come through the door as Chris, we could have, you know, light the path to my office, but don't light up the entire building. It knows that I prefer the temperature at 68 degrees in my office. So it turns it on for me and makes sure that it's, you know, we're a lot of overseas, you'll see the air conditioners, instead of controlling the whole building, they're kind of like mini splits for each individual conference room or even office. Well, now we can, from a green certification, LEED certification, green buildings, we can then only climate control that. Think of how many people only come into the office once a day or once a week. Mm-hmm. Well, if, why run all the lights and all the HVAC if we don't have to, right? And that's where this convenience can start to come in. It knows that I'm in my office and I'm moving around, or, you know, any number of things like that. But it's, you know, the door has been locked behind me as I approach the conference room. It knows that I've got a meeting scheduled and who I am, and so it lets me into the conference room. There's just a lot of things that can start to happen as a result of that. So-and-so's out, so I'm their replacement. I get deemed that, so now I have access to a higher security room, because I need it for, as I'm covering for somebody for a couple of days. Like, the systems can be more dynamic in what they can perform. And I think that goes back to that software first, because the software facilitates that and tells the hardware what to do, sort of, you know, in that regard. So yeah, I think that's the seamless. That's the increased user experience that ultimately I think is going to be for the best, right? I think that's going to be, makes our everyday lives a lot more comfortable from a lighting and HVAC control and, you know, ease of use.
Yeah, definitely. 100%. And that's, I think some people get a little hesitant at it, you know, because it's progressing into what's kind of been, what should I say? Like, personified in sci-fi and, you know, the troubles that come with that and identity issues and stuff like that. And I think that also what you said to you don't really know what that's going to be if the reader goes away. I think the industry really doesn't know what that's going to be, because there's enough out there that are, you know, we're pushing this product or we're pushing that. And there isn't really they haven't really landed on, like, this is kind of a industry standard that you use this to create that seamless experience. So there's a lot to learn there, and I know that you'll be at the forefront of it for sure, you know. But
I appreciate it, man. It's opportunities for improvement, right? They're all around us. All around us.
For sure. Well, hey, we're almost to time, and that I really just appreciate you coming on. These are the types of conversations that I wish that I could just get paid to have every single day. You know what I'm saying? Like this, because these are the things that stimulate my mind. I know that they stimulate the people listening to this. You know, we should be thinking about this for the entire spectrum, from the C-suite to the technician. If we're all kind of in sync and looking forward to what's coming, then it'll be adopted easier. It'll be adopted more securely. And we won't really have like one kind of wheel lagging behind on our security vessel, if you will. So I really appreciate it, man. Is there anything else that you want to kind of say to, I want to give you a minute to just kind of give a word to the technician, because I know from your background and from my background, we kind of resonate in that. And sometimes I get guys on here on this segment that are much more on that C-suite side, much more on that management admin side, which is very important. But being that we kind of came from that world or that realm, is there any last words that you would want to say?
Well, I think the first thing is, like, for the technicians out there listening, like, we love you guys. You guys are awesome. The boots on the ground, the people in the field, with the snips and the screwdrivers in hand, like, that's the people that make this industry work. There's a lot of people that get a lot of glory for sales and marketing and all that, but without it, without the technician involved, like, it just doesn't happen. So know that you're seen, know that you're appreciated, and we're grateful to have you, everybody in that realm. Keep up with it. Keep up with what the industry's doing. You know, I know people who have started and retired as a technician, and they're, you know, ain't nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I got no hard feelings there. If you want other things in your career, they're out there, they're possible. But also, if you truly just love being a tech, own it and do it and continue to progress there. So, you know, for sure. And one other shout out, I'll just say that to some of the other, you know, if this is anybody's first time on here in this podcast, shame on you. There's a ton of great episodes. You're listening to one of the best here. Tell your mom, tell your sister, tell your dad, tell your brother,
right.
Tell everybody you know to be joining in and listening on Security Today podcast. I appreciate you, Bear, from an industry perspective and having that word, getting that message out there. You know, I think that the industry needs more good voices, and you are one of the few and the top of that. So I truly appreciate it, and I hope everybody tells everybody they know to listen to all the back episodes and keep it going, because you're killing it, man.
Well, I appreciate that. And yes, that I love hearing tell your mother, because that's what I say, you know. Tell your mom, call her up, tell her you're doing better because you're listening to this podcast. But yeah, definitely. And you know, those back episodes, man, they still resonate. They still hit. So definitely, if you get a chance, go listen to those. Go listen to the prior interviews from this segment, which started last fall, and the Bid to Bank segment, which started last summer. So it's just kind of rolling along. But yeah, man, you fit in right here real well. So you're a Security Today veteran, and we'll get you back on the podcast for sure. So thanks for coming out, man.
Appreciate it, man.
We'll talk to you
later.
Thank
you. Thanks for the opportunity.